This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, January 12, 2007. From KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Aura Bogado. Thousands of demonstrators protest against Bush's Iraq war strategy as more plans are revealed. The British government considers the viability of a new program aimed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And soldiers and federal agents begin a new chapter in the militarization of a northern Mexico border town. We'll bring you those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. The government of Greece has blamed domestic terrorists for launching a projectile today at the U.S. Embassy in Athens. The embassy was closed at the time. The projectile broke some windows and caused minor damage to a third-floor bathroom. U.S. Ambassador Charles Rees described the incident as a, quote, very serious attack. A Cuban-born man considered a terrorist in at least two countries has been indicted by a West Texas grand jury for lying to U.S. immigration officials. Leslie Clark reports.
A federal grand jury yesterday indicted Luis Posada Carriles on one count of naturalization fraud and six counts of lying to federal officials while seeking U.S. citizenship. Posada entered the United States illegally in 2005 and has been in prison in El Paso, Texas since his arrest in May of that year. Posada, a former CIA operative, is considered a terrorist by both Cuba and Venezuela, who say he was involved in the bombing of a Cuban airliner in 1976, which killed all 73 people on board. Cuban authorities say Posada Carriles masterminded the bombings of two Cuban hotels in 1997. The U.S. has rejected requests to extradite Posada Carriles to either Venezuela or Cuba. Instead, the U.S. government asks seven different countries to give Posada asylum. All seven have refused. If found guilty of the charges he faces, Posada Carriles could spend up to 10 years in prison for naturalization fraud and 5 years in prison on each of the six false statement counts. Posada Carriles is due to appear in court next week. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leslie Clark in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
A Texas judge has moved to halt a controversial anti-immigrant ordinance from going into effect in a Dallas suburb. Renee Feltz reports.
Last month, city council members for the Dallas suburb of Farmers Branch voted to ban apartment owners from leasing to undocumented immigrants or pay a $500 a day fine for violations. Thursday, a state judge temporarily blocked the new ordinance, a day before it was set to go into effect. The judge granted the temporary restraining order in response to a resident's allegation that council members violated an open meetings law by deliberating behind closed doors and then voting on the ordinance before residents had a chance to read it and submit comments. Later this month, the judge will hear a request to halt the measure until the case goes to trial. Earlier this week, residents presented a petition that forces the city to hold a public vote on the ordinance in May. Council members approved the petition, but had planned to enforce the ban in the meantime. The city faces several other lawsuits, including one that alleges the ordinance is so poorly written it could ban legal immigrants from renting and fails to provide clear instructions for apartment landlords. Thursday, local merchants filed a fourth lawsuit, this one alleging the ordinance has made Latino customers avoid Farmers Branch altogether. That suit seeks damages for loss of revenue and future profits. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Renee Feltz.
The House of Representatives today passed a plan for the government to negotiate prescription drug prices for Medicare recipients. Democrats hope this will be the first step towards rewriting parts of Medicare's prescription drug regulations. The measure is part of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's plan to pass a series of Democratic objectives in the first few days of Congress. President Bush said Thursday he would veto the bill if it reaches his desk. But before that can happen, the measure must first pass the Senate, where at least one Republican senator has vowed to filibuster. Whether Senate Democrats have the 60 votes necessary to override such opposition is unclear. Activists in New York are pushing the state legislature to pass tough anti-trafficking laws. From New York, Rebecca Miles has the story.
New York City is one of the country's busiest ports of entry, and because of this has been a strategic location for human trafficking operations. New York City's council members and activists want the state's legislature to approve measures that would create stronger penalties for traffickers and those who buy sex from the victims of trafficking operations. They also want a state-funded rehabilitation program for trafficking victims. Speaking yesterday on the steps of New York's Supreme Court, feminist Gloria Steinem said the worldwide figures of trafficked girls and women is close to 12 million, making it larger than the slave trade of the 18th century.
It is bigger now than it was then. It is more profitable than the illegal slave trade. We cannot close our eyes to it. We need another abolitionist movement.
The law that the anti-trafficking activists want has failed in the state legislature for the past 3 years. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rebecca Miles reporting.
Demonstrators filled the central plaza of Cochabamba, Bolivia today, calling for the ouster of the provincial governor. Bolivian media reports indicate that at least 2 people died yesterday after a group of pro-government thugs attacked demonstrators. Small farmers, students, and organized labor have been mobilizing since last week and have vowed to keep up the pressure in the streets until the governor steps down. And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
About 500 people braved 25-degree weather outside the White House last night to protest the escalation of the war in Iraq. Jeff Covite is the father of Gavin Covite, who served a tour of duty in Iraq. Jeff is a Navy veteran himself, a member of Military Family Speak Out, and a speaker at the White House demonstration.
I can't stay home any longer. Too many things are going on in this country, and I think the people of this country have to stand up and take a stand. Not that this president's ever going to listen to the people, of course, but the Congress will, hopefully. But now that we have a new Congress, maybe they'll have the courage to stand up to this man and do what has to be done to pull him back from what many people feel are some very wrong decisions.
According to organizers, there were similar protests against Bush's announcement of troop escalations in more than 1,000 U.S. cities. Jen Rogers participated in a rush hour march through San Francisco last night.
I was just really enraged because he doesn't seem to get it. And the rest of the country is shouting at him, stop this insanity. And I believe he's trying to save his presidency and his legacy. And he's just down the wrong path.
A somber tone remains 2 days after the president announced more troops are heading to Iraq, but a few more details of the plan were revealed. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports.
Secretary of Defense Robert Gates and General Peter Pace, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, appeared for a second day of testimony, this time before the Senate Armed Services Committee. The president's new plan in Iraq says that American support is not open-ended. Today, Secretary Gates revealed some of the benchmarks the Iraqi government must meet. First, for the Iraqis to provide the troops they promised. Second, there must be no political interference at the top levels of the government. And finally, if the American and Iraqi troops are able to enter into all neighborhoods in Baghdad.
So I think that the first indicators for this committee, for the Congress, and frankly for the president, of whether this operation is being successful or not, is whether the Iraqis fulfill the commitments they've made on the military side. And we should know that in a couple of months.
In the next couple of months, only the first 2 or 3 additional brigades will be deployed. Gates said not all additional troops will be sent before the U.S. can determine the Iraqis' commitment.
We will have, before we have sent in very many additional American troops, we will have a pretty good idea whether, at least on the military side, the Iraqis have stepped up to the plate in terms of fulfilling their commitments.
Lawmakers' tone today presented a stark contrast to yesterday's hearing with Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, where many senators, both Republicans and Democrats, expressed blatant outrage. Today, the mood was somber and presented respectful inquisition. In the second day of hearings, the opinion of one influential senator, John Warner, Republican of Virginia, and former Navy Secretary and usual supporter of the war, was still undecided about the troop increase.
And I really believe, drawing on my own lifetime of experience, this moment in American history is a very critical one. And I observed the president's conclusion that it would be a disaster if we were to allow Iraq to implode, be divided, and scattered to the winds in that region. So we must find a way to avoid that.
But the opinions of many lawmakers are already formed. A group of 24 House Democrats convened a forum Friday morning to talk about an exit strategy. Addressing the forum was Middle Eastern scholar Dr. William Polk. He co-authored the book, Out of Iraq.
Will Iraq just implode if we leave? And the honest answer is that we can't possibly prevent it if it does. But we do offer in our plan the best means we can find to make it less likely to happen. Experience in a dozen other insurgencies over the last 50 years illustrates that when the irritant, that is the foreign occupier, leaves, fighting dies down. Why is this? It's simply because we're all human beings of all religions, nationalities, races, political systems, are territorial, like territorial animals. We don't like foreigners, and we won't tolerate being ruled by them. Our own revolution demonstrated this. So when the main objective, getting us out, is held to be by at least 80% of the Iraqis, when that's accomplished, they won't keep on sacrificing to support the combatants.
Both Republicans and Democrats in both the House and the Senate are figuring out next steps. Both Democrats and a small group of Republicans each wrote letters to the president expressing opposition to his troop escalation. And House Speaker Nancy Pelosi met with Democratic leaders about Iraq this afternoon. And Representative Charles Rangel, Democrat of New York, introduced legislation that would implement the draft. Military leaders said some brigades will have to extend their tour in Iraq by 3 or 4 months to fulfill number requirements. And this coming Monday, petitions will be sent to members of Congress signed by more than 1,000 active duty service members calling for an end to the war. They chose Martin Luther King Jr. Day because of Dr. King's opposition to the war in Vietnam. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
George Bush could run into problems with his plans to escalate the Iraq War and increase the size of the standing Army and Marine Corps. Already, the Pentagon is having difficulty meeting its recruitment goals. And as FSRN's Aaron Glantz reports, there are signs the military is already sending the mentally unstable into combat.
Susan Tileston hasn't seen her son Levi Modrell in more than 2 years. Levi served in the 101st Airborne Division in Afghanistan and then Iraq. The Eastern Kentucky mom says her son returned home for Christmas in 2003, but wasn't the same.
He came home very distressed. Very distressed.
Tileston says her son had scars on the back of his head that he refused to talk about. When he was supposed to return to nearby Fort Campbell a month later, he disappeared.
I haven't spoken to him on the phone. I've gotten no letters or communications. He hasn't talked to any of his friends or any of his aunts or uncles or cousins. He hasn't touched his bank account since March 8th of 04.
In September 2004, Tileston listed her son as a missing person with the state of Kentucky, but all the police could find was a traffic citation from Florida. Tileston says she doesn't know where her son is, but she has an idea about why he's gone.
When he was running cover for the convoys, you know, he's a good soldier, he takes his job serious, and he's a sharpshooter marksman, whatever they hand him. Well, an 8-year-old kid with an AKA was firing on his contractors. And he shot back and had to kill an 8-year-old kid. And I think that's when he lost it.
President Bush's plan to send 21,000 additional U.S. soldiers to Iraq involves the redeployment of many soldiers suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. Press reports indicate Bush wants to implement his surge by speeding up previously scheduled redeployments and extending tours of soldiers already in the field of battle. That scares Kentucky mom Anita Dennis. In 2004, her son, Specialist Daryl Anderson, received the Purple Heart for taking shrapnel to protect the rest of his unit from a roadside bomb. In 2005, he fled to Canada, saying he could no longer fight in what he called an illegal war.
Daryl said he was so screwed up in the head when he came back from Iraq. That's why he had to go to Canada. That was like a desperate effort to save his life because he could not face the military.
In an attempt to implement President Bush's plan to increase the combined size of the Army and Marine Corps by 92,000, the Pentagon has raised the enlistment bonus from $20,000 to $40,000, raised the age limit of new recruits from 34 to 43, allowed for fatter soldiers and soldiers who score lower on aptitude tests, and those with visible tattoos. Anita Dennis says the U.S. military is so desperate for soldiers, they deny necessary treatment to those deployed in the field of battle.
Well, there was a guy in Daryl's unit that when Daryl got wounded by the roadside bomb, this guy got hit, another guy got hit, this guy was there. This guy got so freaked out that every time they went out on a mission, they left that guy there playing video games. Daryl was like, look, this guy's messed up. Shouldn't we call his parents? Should we send him back to Germany? Shouldn't we be getting them treatment? No, we're just going to leave him here because if we give him treatment, we have to admit he's messed up.
Sometimes the military's decision to keep mentally unstable soldiers in combat produces tragic results. The Associated Press reported Tuesday that an Army private charged with raping a young Iraqi woman and slaughtering her entire family last year was found to have homicidal ideations by a military mental health team 3 months before the attack. According to the AP, Private First Class Stephen Green told military psychiatrists he was angry about the war, desperate to avenge the death of comrades, and driven to kill Iraqi citizens. The AP reports medical records show the Pentagon doctors prescribed Green several small doses of Seroquel, a drug to regulate his mood, and directed him to get some sleep. 1 month later, after the examination, Green reportedly told his battalion commander that he hated all Iraqis. He also allegedly threw a puppy from the roof of a building and then set the animal on fire while on patrol. But through it all, he was kept on duty, manning a checkpoint in one of the most dangerous areas of Iraq. Through it all, the U.S. military kept him in combat. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz.
Thousands of soldiers took control of Bangladesh's capital city of Dhaka in the South Asian country that's been going through political turmoil over the fairness of upcoming elections. Soldiers arrested an opposition politician today in a pre-dawn raid, one day after the president declared a nationwide state of emergency and postponed upcoming elections after weeks of often violent protests. FSRN's Vinod K. Jose reports.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
That was Bangladeshi President Iyawuddin Ahmed announcing his decision to step down as caretaker of the interim government. He also handed over the streets of Dhaka city for its armed forces, declaring an emergency. Streets of Dhaka have been witnessing high-voltage protests for the last 4 months as people demand a free and fair election. The protest was organized by a 14-party opposition alliance led by the Awami League. Their main accusation is that the interim government is acting as a puppet formation that favors the opposition's main rival, the Bangladesh Nationalist Party. After violent protests on the streets, the elections have been postponed and a revised voter list promised. The decision to do so came soon after the United Nations and the European Union decided to suspend election monitoring duties. Debapriya Bhattacharya is the executive director of Dhaka Center for Policy Dialogue. He believes it was a good decision by the United Nations to back off.
We are not going to have, regrettably, an acceptable government which is going to come through this process. Obviously, if the international community go on observing a non-competitive, unparticipated election, then obviously it is going to create problem for the international community because they're going to give legitimacy to the whole process by observing it.
For quite some time, the political leadership of Bangladesh has been decided by two women leaders, Begum Khalidasia of Bangladesh Nationalist Party and Sheikh Hasina of Awami League. While Begum Khalidasia is the widow of former military general Ziaur Rahman, Sheikh Hasina is the eldest daughter of the country's founding father, Sheikh Mujibur Rahman. Rahman had socialist leanings and was assassinated by a group of army officers in 1975. It was later alleged that the US Central Intelligence Agency had a role in his assassination. During the freedom struggle, Sheikh Rahman made a historic address known as the March 7th speech of 1971. It became the battle cry for Bengali independence. Ironically, 35 years after this speech, his eldest daughter Sheikh Hasina, leader of the opposition alliance, is delivering similar words, this time upset over the current internal crisis.
It is a cry for rights. It is a cry for representation. We don't want to be party to an arranged election. We have to go for an election boycott, only to protect the people's democratic right to vote. We want an election in which all the parties can participate, not a stage-managed one.
Today, over 60,000 soldiers took control of the streets of Dhaka. Reports of arrests and detentions are coming out from the country. Under Bangladesh's constitution, many fundamental rights are suspended during a state of emergency. Strict restrictions on media are also put in place. Printing and broadcasting critical political news, photographs and cartoons are banned. The Bangladesh government in exile adopted this song as the national anthem. It appeals to the country, called Mother, to be happy. But for now at least, the mother is definitely unhappy. For FSRN, from New Delhi, this is Vinod Kijus.
Europe's much-heralded emissions trading system failed to persuade companies, which are the biggest polluters, to reduce their emissions. Instead, emissions are on the rise, and many companies made windfall profits in the first year. The British government is now considering the viability of a personal carbon accounting system. But would Britain's proposed scheme be any more effective at reducing greenhouse gas emissions? FSRN's Naomi Fowler reports from London.
Imagine a future where your personal carbon account becomes as familiar as your bank account. Imagine if each time you swiped your bank card to fill your car with gas or settle your household heating bill, your carbon units were also deducted from your annual carbon allowance. And if you'd used up your allowance, you'd pay extra cash for the emissions rights. The British Environment Minister has instructed government officials to investigate and report back to him on the feasibility of just such a scheme for Britain.
Everybody gets the same number of these emissions rights, or we call them carbon units.
Richard Starkey of the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research is working on a domestic tradable quota scheme.
And so if you are a low emitter, for instance, if you don't drive very many miles in your car, or if you've got a well-insulated home, or you've got an efficient boiler in your house, you're not going to be releasing very many emissions. You're going to have some surplus carbon units in your account. On the other hand, if you're a high emitter, you're not going to have enough carbon units to cover all your emissions, so you're going to need to buy more. And so those people who have low emissions can sell their surplus carbon units and make themselves some money.
While citizens would get their carbon allocation for free, companies would have to buy their carbon units on the open market. And the government's finance minister would reduce the carbon points or emissions rights allocated each year. But editor of the New Internationalist and member of Carbon Trade Watch, Adam Marnett, thinks market-based systems like this one, being considered by the British, avoid essential legislatory enforcement. He says carbon trading is letting governments and corporations, the biggest polluters, off the hook.
Government subsidizes the fossil fuel industry. Most oil, coal and gas has enormous amounts of tax credits and breaks export-import credits and so forth, which distort the market, actually, and make it very difficult for renewable energy companies to compete. Corporate lobby groups in the European Union have been unanimous in supporting the EU emissions trading scheme precisely because they know they can benefit from that system. And they have. The last year alone, the six top electricity generators in the UK made something to the tune of £1 billion in windfall profits from the EU emissions trading system. They were able to benefit both from the market and to make the consumers pay even more. They in fact increased their emissions by 2% last year.
There are legislative success stories that the British government would do well to observe. For example, the US and Germany addressed their rising sulfur dioxide emissions very differently. While the US implemented a trading scheme, Germany legislated.
The German government regulated industry and it said you must reduce your emissions by this amount by this time, and it led to 60% reductions in a period of 10 years. So the government regulatory system worked better than the US system, which at the moment, that US system has led to increases at the moment. Last 2 years, the level of sulfur dioxide emissions in the United States have actually been on the increase.
According to many scientists and environmentalists, what the world really needs to do is cut subsidies to the fossil fuel industry, which would make renewable energy more viable, offer integrated public transport links, legislate against airport expansion, promote energy conservation, and regulate industry. Otherwise, they say, the carbon trading approach may just facilitate business as usual. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
It's been a little more than a week since the start of Operation Tijuana, a major Mexican military offensive aimed to crack down on organized crime in the sometimes violent border city. And already, soldiers and federal agents have taken over the streets of Tijuana, beginning a new chapter in the militarization of northern Mexico border towns. FSRN's Alonso Rivera reports from Tijuana.
Mexico's National Security Cabinet unexpectedly announced the start of a massive security operation in Tijuana on the morning of January 2nd. By the end of the day, more than 3,000 soldiers, Marines, and federal policemen had arrived with 28 boats, 21 planes, and 9 helicopters with orders to mount checkpoints and patrol the city by land, air, and sea. By the morning of January 3rd, heavily armed federal, state, and local police agents patrolled the city. Soldiers in combat fatigue set up roadblocks in every major access to Tijuana, and helicopters began flying over the city with the same pilots that flew over Oaxaca during last November's confrontation. The commanding officer of Operation Tijuana is General Héctor Sánchez Gutiérrez.
Lo vamos a hacer en forma coordinada. Vamos a hacer un trabajo intenso de inteligencia.
At first, we are going to do an intense intelligence work through mixed patrolling, so we can have presence and work on prevention, and intelligence work on specific targets we come across.
General Sánchez Gutiérrez recently led a similar effort in Michoacán. Last month's Operation Michoacán involved a force of 7,000 federal agents and soldiers, and its purpose was to crack down on organized crime and eradicate drug plantations in the state's rural areas. It was the first major security operation ordered by the new president and the first to involve Mexican military cooperation with federal agencies in decades. Local authorities and many sectors of the business community applauded the recent arrival of troops. More prosperous sectors of the Tijuana population had been threatened by a recent wave of kidnappings, supposedly perpetrated by members of drug trafficking cartels, finding alternate means of financing their operations. But Francisco Sánchez Corona, Baja California's human rights district attorney, believes that Operation Tijuana looks more like a media campaign for federal authorities than a real battle against organized crime. Preliminary results from the operation reveal that military safety checkpoints and roadblocks have only resulted in detentions of small-time delinquents.
El que haya más delincuentes en las cárceles no es sinónimo.
I believe that a higher number of delinquents in jail does not mean safer streets.
Human rights advocates have long opposed military involvement in civilian law enforcement, citing the dreadful experiences of the Dirty War, a time when the Mexican government used soldiers to capture, torture, and kill political dissidents and leftist activists. But recent experiences of military activities have also resulted in major abuses and human rights violations. Victor Clark Alfaro, director of the Binational Human Rights Center and an expert in public security, referred to the extortion and raping of Central American undocumented migrant women by soldiers in Mexico's southern rural states, a problem that has been followed and extensively documented by human rights activists.
The problem is not documenting, but combating these types of violations because of the way they handle judicial cases, with their own judges and tribunals, making them an independent power difficult to penetrate.
However, the militarization of the Mexican society had begun long before Operation Tijuana, with the creation of the Federal Preventive Police in 1998, a public safety corporation comprised mostly of former soldiers that operates with procedures similar to the armed forces. For now, Tijuana citizens can only wait for the dust cloud to settle and demand results within reasonable time, while uniformed men with loaded assault rifles march through town in intimidating caravans, performing a massive display of power that's supposedly making their lives safer. In Tijuana, this is Alonso Rivera for Free Speech Radio News.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Aura Abogado.